Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Dr. Zed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Francine are joined by Dr. Daniel Baffa, Assistant Professor of Thoracic Surgery, and Dr. Jill Lacey, Associate Professor of Medical Oncology. Both Dr. Baffa and Dr. Lacey are experts in the treatment of esophageal cancer.
Maybe, Dan, we can start off by defining for our listeners, what is esophageal cancer?
Well, esophageal cancer is an abnormal growth of the cells that line the esophagus. And the esophagus is the swallowing tube that starts at the back of your mouth and goes through your chest and into your abdomen, where it connects your intestine with your stomach. And the cancer is a loss of ability of a cell to control its own growth. And so not only does that cell grow out of control, it loses its borders with the neighboring cells, and not only grows through the tissues of the esophagus, but can enter the bloodstream and can spread throughout the body.
Jill, esophageal cancer is one of the fastest rising cancers in the United States. Can you talk a little bit about what causes it and what the incidence is in the United States?
Sure. So this dramatic increase in the incidence of esophagus cancer is due to an increase in one type of esophagus cancer called adenocarcinoma. And actually, since 1975, the annual incidence of adenocarcinoma in the United States has increased by a dramatic 400%. And this is at a time when the incidence of the second major type of esophagus cancer called squamous cell carcinoma has actually been decreasing. So what is behind this, what has been referred to as an epidemic of adenocarcinoma of the esophagus? The reality is that we really don't know for sure. We think it may be related in part to a rising prevalence of acid reflux disease. We do know that long-standing chronic reflux of stomach acid up into the esophagus can cause precancerous changes in the lining of the esophagus. This is something called Barrett's esophagus. And Barrett's, we do know, is a very significant risk factor for ultimately developing adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. We also think that obesity may be at play here as well. There is very strong epidemiologic data that links obesity and an increased body mass index to an increased incidence of esophagus cancer, as well as a number of other cancers. But there really are many unanswered questions about why we've had this dramatic increase in incidence of adenocarcinoma of the esophagus.
So, Dan, can you tell us how many cases there are in the United States and what age groups are primarily affected?
So there's about 16,000 new cases last year in the United States. The majority of patients are in their seventh or eighth decade, so they would be in their 70s, late 60s through their late 70s. But that being said, all ages, all adult ages can be affected by this, and we see this in patients in their 30s as well as patients in their 80s.
And Jill, maybe you could just kind of go through again some of the main risk factors for developing esophageal cancer?
Sure. There are a number of factors that have been clearly identified which increase the risk of developing esophagus cancer. And these risk factors actually differ quite significantly between the two major types that I have referred to, adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. So for squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus, there really are two major risk factors, tobacco use and alcohol consumption. And each of these independently increase the risk of squamous cell carcinoma, and when used together, the risk is actually significantly amplified. So patients or individuals who are at highest risk of developing squamous cell carcinoma are individuals who are cigarette smokers and smoke heavily, and also are heavy drinkers of hard liquor. And their risk is about 100-fold over the general population. Some of the other risk factors associated with squamous cell carcinoma include poverty, malnutrition, diets low in fresh fruits and vegetables, or certain vitamins and minerals. Now, the story is different for adenocarcinoma. There, the major risk factors are long-standing acid reflux disease, or GERD, as I had mentioned before, and it's linked to Barrett's esophagus. And Barrett's is really the major risk factor for adenocarcinoma. Obesity also is a risk factor, as I had mentioned. Tobacco is only a moderate risk factor for adenocarcinoma, increases the risk by about 2 to 3-fold. And alcohol does not appear to be a risk factor at all for adenocarcinoma, in contrast to squamous cell carcinoma. And in fact, there's some recent data that suggests that drinking wine may actually have a protective effect on the development of adenocarcinoma, although certainly that needs to be validated and would not be considered a reason to go out and start consuming wine.
So, Dan, Barrett's esophagus is a term that we've heard is a risk factor, and I believe that that's primarily a surgical issue, something that you would address. Can you talk about it and what to do about it if you have it?
So Barrett's esophagus is the body's response to seeing conditions that it wasn't designed for. So the body was meant to propel food in a one-way direction, and that's forward. When patients get reflux disease, the esophagus is exposed to things from the stomach that it wasn't designed to see, specifically acid as well as some bile acids. And in response to this, the esophagus is injured, and the esophagus tries to protect itself by reverting to a type of lining that looks like the intestine downstream of the stomach, which normally sees the gastric acid all the time. And that sounds like a good idea. Unfortunately, once it converts into this intestinal type lining, it loses control over its ability to regulate its growth. And over time, that Barrett's can actually transform into something called dysplasia. And dysplasia is where Barrett's is a metaplasia, which is just a change to a different kind of lining. Dysplasia is a change to a more irregular, less controlled lining, and that's what's really at risk to convert into a cancer. If you have Barrett's esophagus, we really don't know exactly the best way to treat you for Barrett's. It is more of a marker of a potential to form a cancer. So if you took everybody that has Barrett's esophagus, that group is more likely to have cancer, but it's on the order of about 0.5% per year. So you don't need to rush off and have your esophagus removed just because you have Barrett's.
Now, Dan, what would be the symptoms that would be typically associated with, say, someone who's developed or beginning to develop Barrett's esophagus?
So the patients who have frequent heartburn, who are on acid suppressive medicines like Zantac, Pepcid, they are at risk to develop this Barrett's because they are having things reflux into their esophagus and are at risk to develop this metaplasia, this Barrett's. About 14% of all patients who have significant reflux, who are taking daily acid suppressive medicines, excuse me, will develop Barrett's. On the other hand, 20% of patients with Barrett's have no symptoms at all. So if you do have symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux disease and you are taking acid suppressive therapy, it is reasonable to have an upper endoscopy at some point to assess whether or not you have this change. Once you do have Barrett's, and that's something that you can actually see when you do an upper endoscopy, it's a microscopic change that leads to a different appearance of the lining. So just by looking at it, you can tell if somebody has Barrett's. Then you need to be followed more closely because you are at increased risk for esophageal cancer.
So if you get scoped and you don't have Barrett's and you continue on those acid-suppressing medications, can you be reassured that you won't develop Barrett's, or do you need to be scoped on a frequent basis to prevent that?
Well, that we don't know. So we have ways of sort of categorizing risk, and unfortunately, nobody's risk of esophageal cancer is zero. So having long-standing reflux disease, we don't know exactly when how much reflux you need to have before you develop Barrett's. So I would say that if you have a negative upper endoscopy, that is reassuring. But if you continue to have long-standing reflux disease, getting a follow-up upper endoscopy 5 to 10 years later is probably a reasonable thing to do. Unfortunately, we don't have enough information to give hard and fast guidelines, but you should definitely be in contact with a gastroenterologist if you do have gastroesophageal reflux type symptoms, even if you've had one negative upper endoscopy.
Jill, once, say, true esophageal cancer develops, you know, what are the typical symptoms associated with that? Is it similar or perhaps different than, say, the symptoms associated with Barrett's esophagus?
There is some overlap. The overwhelming majority of patients, about 75% with esophagus cancer, will present to their physician with the complaint of food getting stuck and difficulty swallowing, what we call dysphagia. And that is usually progressive over a few weeks to, in some cases, months. It can be associated with weight loss due to decreased intake of food in about 50 to 60% of patients, and significant or dramatic weight loss is an adverse prognostic factor in terms of outcome. Only about 20% of patients actually complain of pain when they swallow, what we call odynophagia. And we've been talking about acid reflux. About 20 to 30% of patients will actually give a history of long-standing and in many cases severe acid reflux. Rarely patients will present with more advanced disease, with cough, difficulty breathing, hoarseness, recurrent pneumonias, but that's much less common. I would emphasize that, and this has already been emphasized by Dan, that acid reflux is extremely common in our population. And so just by virtue of having acid reflux doesn't mean that you are going to or ever will get esophageal cancer. And similarly, dysphagia, although certainly needs to be evaluated, can be caused by a number of benign conditions as well.
So Jill, as you were talking, it occurred to me that a lot of these symptoms are things that many people have. And so how often do you actually see somebody coming in very late who's had these symptoms and kind of chalk them off to something else?
It certainly happens. I think most patients, when they're having difficulty swallowing and food is hanging up, will consult with their physician within a reasonable period of time.
And if any of these symptoms should pop up, who should the individual go seek attention first? Should it be their primary care physician? You know, should it be you, Dan, the surgeon, or you, Jill, the medical oncologist? Kind of maybe take us through the process of, mm-hmm. you know, who these individuals should see.
So if someone is noticing for the first time difficulty swallowing or severe acid reflux symptoms, probably they should start with their primary care physician and undergo an evaluation there, and then he or she can make appropriate referrals to a gastroenterologist and then go from there.
Yeah, I think that if you're having difficulty swallowing, I think that you really need to have an upper endoscopy or a barium swallow. And I think most general practitioners are very aggressive at pursuing the diagnosis of esophageal cancer. However, if somebody's with their primary care physician and don't feel that is progressing, then they should feel free to contact a gastroenterologist themselves or a surgeon themselves.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dan, for that. We're going to go to a break now. You're here listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we have Dr. Dan Boffa and Dr. Jill Lacey discussing the treatment of esophageal cancer.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Drs. Dan Boffa and Jill Lacey, experts in esophageal cancer from the Yale Cancer Center. So, Dan, we talked a little bit about the risk factors for esophageal cancer and Barrett's esophagus. Can you tell us how esophageal cancer is diagnosed?
So, esophageal cancer is diagnosed by a biopsy, and it's performed during an upper endoscopy. And one of the themes that we will try to convey to you is the importance of being cared for by a center that has experience with esophageal cancer. The condition we've mentioned before, Barrett's esophagus, has a tendency to convert to something called dysplasia, which can either be low or high-grade dysplasia, and that's just it reflects the degree to which the cells have become abnormal. Can look very much like a cancer, and the diagnosis can be difficult to establish. And so at Yale, we have pathologists who are specialized in reviewing esophageal cancer cases. And it's important that more than one pathologist examine a biopsy to establish the diagnosis of cancer.
And Jill, once the diagnosis of esophageal cancer is made, you know, what goes into the evaluation process to determine whether or not the cancer is localized or perhaps more advanced?
Right. So once we have a diagnosis, it's important to stage the patient, and that means determining how big the tumor is and whether it's spread to any other sites in the body. Staging is very important as it determines our treatment, and it also determines prognosis. And staging is based for esophagus cancer on three aspects of the disease. One is how deeply the tumor in the esophagus actually penetrates into the wall of the esophagus. The second component is whether the tumor has spread to the surrounding lymph glands or lymph nodes in the region of the esophagus. And then the third component is whether the tumor has spread to distant sites in the body, such as the liver or the lungs or bones. And from those three components, we use a four-tier staging system, as we do in many solid tumors, going from stage one to stage four. So stage one would be a very superficial tumor in the lining of the esophagus that's not actually penetrated into the muscular wall of the esophagus. At the other end of the spectrum, we have stage four disease, and in that situation, the tumor has spread to distant sites in the body, again, such as the liver. And then stage two and three disease, you may have a tumor that has invaded deeply into the wall of the esophagus or has spread to the lymph nodes or lymph glands in the region of the esophagus.
At the time of diagnosis, Jill, what percentage of patients are early stage versus advanced stage?
Well, the majority of patients present with either stage two or three disease.
What's unusual about esophageal cancer relates to the anatomy of the esophagus. It's a muscular tube, but it's more like the lining is like layers of a cake. And the esophageal cancer starts on the inside, or the frosting of the cake, if you will. What's unusual about the esophagus is the lymph ducts, which allow the cancer to spread, are actually very close to the inside, or very close to the frosting, to stick with that tasty analogy, which means that a relatively early stage esophageal cancer has a much readier access to spread than, say, a colon cancer or a breast cancer. So if you compared stage per stage, esophageal cancer is a very difficult cancer to manage because of that anatomic reason. It has a earlier propensity to spread.
So it would be very rare to pick up a stage one case, for instance.
Well, Historically, yes. But now that we are doing screening programs, once you have a once you're established at Barrett's esophagus, if you are followed, the chances are you'll be much more likely to be found to have an earlier cancer or even high-grade dysplasia than the more symptom-driven diagnosis, which tends to be the stage 3 cancers.
Dan, maybe you can take us through some of the different treatment options, and I guess in particular the surgical treatment options for this disease.
Sure. So esophageal cancer can be treated with chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery primarily. We have other techniques, but if you had to separate the treatment for esophageal cancer, there's treating the tumor in the esophagus with local therapy, and that just means you're trying to get rid of the tumor where it started. And there's systemic therapy, which means you're treating the whole patient for anything that may have spread. Systemic therapy is chemotherapy. Local therapy can either be radiation, where you try to destroy the tumor by radiating the esophagus and neighboring structures, and surgery, which you remove that part of the esophagus and all of the tissue around it. Esophageal cancer, because of where it is in the body and the extent of surgery you have to do to restore the patient's ability to swallow normally, is a difficult surgery. It's a difficult cancer to treat surgically. It involves a substantial operation. So we select our patients very carefully because the risk of esophageal surgery is much higher than, say, colon surgery or breast surgery. At Yale, every patient we evaluate individually. And if we think there's a risk of them having cancer throughout their body, even if it's microscopic and you can't see it, we give them chemotherapy. Most patients get treated with chemotherapy and radiation followed by surgery, sort of a multimodality approach. And the thought behind that is that we give patients everything we have, because this is a difficult cancer, to both control it where we see it and where we don't.
Jill, can you talk a little bit about the kinds of chemotherapy that are used for esophageal cancer?
Sure. So as Dan has alluded to, the management of esophageal cancer is typically interdisciplinary and involves the use of radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery. And chemotherapy has an important role to play in the management of all stages of esophageal cancer, with the exception of stage 1, which is typically handled with either surgery or focal ablative therapies. So there are two major scenarios where chemotherapy is important. First is in the situation where you have a patient where they do not appear to have metastatic disease, where the plan is to take them to surgery, so they have localized or regional disease. And there, as Dan mentioned, we use chemotherapy in combination with radiation that's administered prior to surgery. This will reduce the size of the tumor, hopefully eradicate any metastatic disease. And this approach has been shown to increase the cure rate overall compared to surgery alone. The most commonly used and established regimen that we use with radiation is a two-drug regimen. These are old drugs, cisplatinum and 5-fluorouracil, and they appear still to be probably the best regimen that we have. We also use chemotherapy, again, in combination with radiation in a patient who may not have metastatic disease, but is not a candidate for surgery because of medical problems that would make the risk of surgery too great. And in that situation, we know that chemotherapy, again, when given with radiation therapy concurrently, not only can shrink the tumor substantially and improve symptoms, but also in about 20% of the patients actually appears to be curative in the long run.
Now, Jill, is there ever any role for giving chemotherapy after the surgical procedure has been performed to remove the esophageal cancer?
Yes, so there are some situations where going into surgery, all the staging studies would support an early stage esophageal cancer, say stage one, and then once the esophagus and all the lymph nodes are removed, we find that the stage is actually higher than that, stage two or three. And that's a situation where we know the patient is at significant risk for recurrent disease, and we certainly would consider using either chemotherapy alone, or in some cases, depending on the location, chemotherapy and radiation therapy in hopes of reducing the risk.
So, Jill, what is the role of some of the newer biological therapies, such as bevacizumab, which is the anti-angiogenesis antibody, in the treatment of esophageal cancer?
So, unfortunately, the majority, more than 50% of patients with esophagus cancer, even best case scenario, will have a recurrence or will present with metastatic disease. And in those settings, we don't at the present have definitive curative treatments. We know that chemotherapy has an important role to play there. Chemotherapy can often dramatically shrink the tumor, thereby improving symptoms such as difficulty swallowing and improve quality of life, and can also significantly extend survival. But chemotherapy over many decades has not been proven to be curative in this situation. So certainly we are searching and looking for better therapies, and there is tremendous interest in these new so-called targeted or biologic therapies. And one such targeted therapy that looks very promising for adenocarcinoma of the esophagus is Avastin or bevacizumab. And this is a targeted therapy that's received a lot of media attention. It is a blood vessel formation inhibitor, so we think it may work by blocking blood supply to tumors. And it's already been approved by the FDA in common cancers such as colon, breast, lung, and just last week in malignant brain tumors. So we think that it may also be an active agent in adenocarcinomas of the esophagus. We have an ongoing study here at Yale using Avastin or bevacizumab in combination with a chemotherapy regimen in patients with adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, also stomach, who have either recurrent disease after initial definitive treatment or present with metastatic disease.
Right. Dan, over the last few years, there really has been an increased use of giving chemotherapy before surgery. And I'm just curious, from your surgeon's perspective, have you noticed, you know, any increased, say, complications resulting from that chemotherapy beforehand, or have you found it to really be much more helpful in allowing you to kind of get in there and surgically remove the tumor?
Well, it's a very big operation, and I can say that the chemotherapy or radiation beforehand doesn't seem to significantly alter the chances of having a complication. Now, that being said, complications are common after esophagectomy, and complications that are well managed don't really affect the long-term outcome. What centers that do esophagectomies with frequency have over centers that don't is their ability to identify complications and manage them safely, so that the overall result is very good. And centers like Yale that see a lot of esophageal cancer and do a lot of esophageal operations have a real advantage over centers that don't, and are able to conduct these elaborate procedures very safely.
So we talk about multimodality care for many cancers, and both of you alluded to the multimodality approach for esophageal cancer. So for most patients who present with this, how do they enter the system?
Well,
how do they hook up with multimodality care?
It's as it's set up right now, if any of the members of the multidisciplinary team, be it Harry Aslanian through gastroenterology, Jill, or myself, once you are referred to any member of the esophageal cancer team, then you become cared for by the team, so that you still are cared for by the physician who referred you, but you are discussed at a tumor board. And we come up with a consensus care plan to move forward.
Great. Well, Jill and Dan, thanks so much for being with on the show this evening, and we look forward to having you back on a future show to hear the latest about what's going on in the treatment of esophageal and gastroesophageal cancer. You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our guests, Drs. Dan Boffa and Jill Lacey, for joining us this evening. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.